Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationships with God. These give fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I was asked to do this at the very last minute, and I don't know the speaker other than her name is Lori. So please welcome Lori.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Lori, an alcoholic. Hi. And it is such an honor to be here. And I love that you read that before a speaker meeting. What a great passage to read that you should describe in from your own point of view how you established your relationship with God. That's just great, because I think that's really one of the things that is most important for me to do when I get up here is to let you know how I established my relationship with God. It is an absolute miracle that I am talking to you right now instead of drunk. It's just truly is. My sobriety date is August 28, 2008, and I absolutely could not. I started drinking. I would say that I drank before this, but alcohol became my solution when I was 17. I actually, in reflection, realized that alcohol had become my solution, and I drank for 19 years until I was humbled to the point of asking for help. But I tell you what, I could not fathom the idea of not drinking. I absolutely, undoubtedly believed that I would drink until I took my last breath. There was no question in my mind, because drinking made me whole. It was as sure to me that I would drink as I would breathe. And it absolutely confused me. Anyone that said that they had stopped drinking, I was like, well, then you don't love drinking as much as I do. I don't know how you would possibly be able to do that. I just couldn't get it. One of the main things for anybody that is new to this, or is coming back, maybe they were on their way and they're coming back, and you know, I just really, it's so important that I'm here to tell you that is absolutely not just possible, but this program is more than a sufficient substitute. I have a life better today than anything I could have ever expected, and I know that sounds like, you know, that sounds hairy-fairy to some of y'all and, you know, a little whatever, but it really is true. My life today is amazing, and it's because of the practical program of action with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is different than the fellowship. You do need the fellowship. That's a beautiful, wonderful thing. Fellowship, service work, unity. But the practical program of action will set you free, and I'll talk about that more. To go back, I was born in South Carolina. Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., but I lived my childhood in South Carolina. My father was a Methodist minister, and so we moved in different cities in South Carolina while I was growing up. So even though I'm from South Carolina, I lived in little different towns in South Carolina. So I was constantly taken to another different small town, so I never really had a base, you know, for whatever that's worth. I never really understood the whole idea of having, you know, friends that you grew up with. I really didn't have that. There was no alcohol in my house, and I really never really understood the whole idea of being able to drink every day, because I didn't know anybody whose parents drank every day. Like the friends when I went to go spend the night, their parents didn't drink. I just didn't know what it was to like drink on a regular day. As I got a little bit older and started hanging out with older friends, then I started to see people that drunk on, you know, they would drink and they, you know, offered me drinks, and I did get drunk a few times, but it still was something that I absolutely enjoyed, but it wasn't something that I did, you know, I did it when it was around, you know, but I didn't do it on any kind of regular basis. But that absolutely had nothing, drinking or not drinking, I still had lots of isms without alcohol. I was still extremely selfish, very self-willed. At 15, I thought I was grown and wanted to get married at 15, thought that I had I fell in love and I was ready to be grown and manipulated the situation as such that my parents were worried that I would skip town and go across God knows where if they didn't sign off on the papers for me to get married. So I was married at 15, divorced at 18, left the house and then moved into a place where I was with a lot of people that drunk and all of this all the time. And when I was 17 and I was still married, and I shouldn't have been married, I so didn't like him, but I really didn't, and he didn't like me. But because of the fact that everybody said this marriage wouldn't work, I was like, I'm going to stick in it, because I so didn't want everybody to be right. You know, so I was like, I'm going to prove they're not right, and I'm going to stick in it, even though I was miserable. But I'm so miserable, and one night I'm with one of my friends, and we're drinking beer, even though, you know, like I said, I didn't drink that often. But we had sat up one night, and we're drinking beer, and we're talking, and the more that I drank, and like I said, I was miserable at this point in my life, miserable. And as I drank beer that night with her, and we're talking, I'm telling you, man, all of the pain and the anguish and the frustration and the hate that I had for the husband that I had right then, it started to lift. It just started to come up off of me. And I remember now, like on reflection, that I made a connection that alcohol was my solution. Like, I knew from that point, that night, that I could deal with anything in my life as long as I was drinking. Like, no matter what was going on, no matter what the circumstances were, if I was drinking, I could deal with anything. And even though I didn't at that time start drinking every day, it wasn't very long after I divorced him, and alcohol gave me the strength to divorce him. Then I moved into a household with people that did drink all the time, and so then I did start drinking every day, and I just kept along on this road of just drinking on a regular basis. And it kept on like this. And I could tell you a whole bunch of stories of how my decline, it just happened and went the way it went. But I'm looking around the room, and I think that y'all all probably have your own story. And so I shouldn't spend a whole lot of time on it, you know, because you can probably fill in your own blanks. I will jump forward to about the last year and a half before I got sober. And at this point, I was such a mess. I mean, I would wake up in the morning and I would drink just immediately, go up and do about 4 shots of tequila as soon as I woke up. That was just first. 4 shots of tequila. And then I would just get started throughout my day, you know, and just keep the alcohol, keep on going as the day went on. And I could not hold a job. I was living in my parents' house because my second husband had kicked me out. My second husband was dying of cancer. He kicked me out because even though he had cancer, he told me I was killing him. That's a big deal. So I ran home to Mom and Dad and drunk under their roof. And they thought they could love my alcoholism out of me. And, of course, anybody who has either tried to love it out of a loved one or has had a loved one try and love it out of them knows that that just doesn't work. All the good intentions, it just doesn't. It's a very sad scenario when that's trying to go down. So, you know, my enablers allowed me to stay at that house just drinking in misery, and I finally decided, you know what, I can't keep a job. I'm, you know, losing days at a time, just days at a time in just drunken fogs. And so I decided I'm going to quit on my own. And this led to a really vicious cycle of, and it's one of those things where, you know, constantly I'm hearing, you need help, you need help. And I know this is going to sound familiar to at least a couple of people. Okay, I know I need to quit, but I know me. I know how to quit. I'll quit on my own. I don't need any help. I know me. I'll do it my own way. And so I did. I tried to, you know, if I only get this job and I start exercising, maybe I'll volunteer and I'll do this, then I'll be able to quit. And I would get maybe about, I don't know, anywhere from 5 to maybe I would make it go to about 3 weeks until I was completely unnerved, insane, until I had to get something to drink. I just had to. And every time I would go to the liquor store and pick up that half gallon of vodka, I would go, all right, I'm going to nurse this bottle. I'm going to nurse this bottle for, like, at least 2 weeks, maybe even a month. You know, I'm going to nurse this bottle. And I would get it home, and I would pour me, you know, go, that big-ass drink, you know, there, and drink it down and be like, that's okay, that was just the first drink. Like, the rest I'm going to hold on to, you know, but it was gone in 3 days. And then I would get another bottle, and then I'm back to alcohol saturation, you know, that alcohol saturation point, for me anyways. And then, you know, after a few, you know, half gallons of vodka, and then I'm at my detox point, you know, where just alcohol saturation where you can't, you know, you're crawling to the bathroom, and then I'm detoxing, throwing up and all this stuff. And, you know, in the middle of a detox, it's real easy to make that firm resolution again, you know. Okay, this is it. I'm not going to drink again this time. All right, this time I'm going to... Well, okay, last time, that was just the wrong job I applied for. This time, I'm gonna apply for this job. And if I volunteer for hospice, and I'm, like, working around people that are sick, it'll help me understand. And, you know, I'll start going to that church group on Monday nights. And this time, I'll be able to stay sober. But I went through this cycle, that exact cycle, that repetitive, vicious cycle. I did that over and over and over again for about a year and a half, y'all. And every time I would walk up, put my hands on that half gallon bottle of vodka and say, I'm going to nurse it this time. And I believed me every single time. Every single time. You could have put me on a lie detector test and said, are you going to nurse that bottle? And that lie detector test would have gone, I mean, I believe me 100%. So It just got to a point that I was such a mess, and I remember it was, well, like I said, about a year and a half into this, and it was somewhere in the end of August. No, not end of August, end of July. And I finally, I was at the end of one of those times of my firm resolution, and it had been a couple of, it had been a couple weeks, and I was crawling out of my skin again. And y'all know that crawling out of your skin thing. You know that crawling out of your skin thing? Where everything in you is just vibrating, and you can, you just feel like you're going absolutely insane, and you feel like if anybody knew how you felt on the inside, they would encourage you to drink. You know, they would encourage you to drink, and people are saying, "You're drinking again." You're like, "No, this is how I'm like when I'm not drinking." You know, and so. Instead of going up to that liquor, liquor store and saying, "I'm going to get this bottle and nurse it," I said, "You know what? I was meant to be an alcoholic. I'm going to live an alcoholic life and die an alcoholic death. That's just the way it is, man." And I felt so good about that decision. I was free. I mean, I was done. I felt so liberated. The fight was over. And so I got 2 gallons of vodka, and I went home and I drank, and I'm still living with my parents, mind you. And they were out of town, and it so reminds me in that part in Bill's story where he says, with a certain satisfaction on that bleak November, there was gin concealed all around my house, and I didn't worry about it being poured down the waste pipe. I wondered if I should hide a bottle near the bed. I would need it before morning. And he describes it as saying a certain satisfaction. I was like, dude, me and Bill, so the same person. I so get Bill. But I got completely, I just drunk and drunk and drunk. And my parents came home from a trip. They were trying to get a hold of me on the phone, and I wouldn't answer, of course. I was too out of it. And when they came home, they got me to a detox. They got me to the ER. And it was the last straw for them. They were done. They were done. I had just completely just wrecked them, and I got to the detox, or I got to the ER, and at the ER they got me into a detox, and at the detox the guy running the detox said to my parents, "Y'all are killing her. You cannot let her go back home." And so the person at detox taught my parents into not letting me come back home. And he said, "You have to go someplace for a long time." And I'm like, "Me? Surely you have me confused with somebody else. I still have this under control." He was like, "No, you need to go away for a long time. You need to have, you need to have recovery in your life on a constant basis for an intelligible period of time." And so I, looked at the places that he had to offer. The first one up there was Any Length Recovery, which was in Sumter, South Carolina. I called them. They accepted me. I ended up there because my parents, I had no home. I didn't have any money. If they weren't letting me come back home, I didn't have any home. I didn't have any friends. There wasn't anybody that claimed me as a friend, and there wasn't anybody I kept in contact with. I mean, the best I could even hope to do was, just play it by ear, dude, on the I was out of ideas of what to do here. I mean, I'm pretty crafty, and my pockets were empty. I did not know what to do except go to this place. And so I show up there, and I'm sitting down on the couch in one of these apartments. And the people that were the residents there, they had gone to a Saturday night meeting. And I'm sitting on the couch in this place, and I'm just like, I cannot believe that this is my life. I can't believe this is my life. I mean, I have nothing. I truly live to drink, drink to live. And now I can't even pull that off. Because all I wanted to do was drink, and now I'm here. You know, I can't even drink right. I failed as a drunk. Dude, what is going on? You know? And so I'm sitting there, and I'm, you know, just sitting there going, what the hell? And I had this vision, I had this clarity that I can only say was God-given, but it was terrifying, of just my future, of my life as I had been living it, because they didn't have chains around this place. I could have walked to the end of the street, hitchhiked, or whatever I chose to do. But it occurred to me that life on my terms, living by my will, was really going badly. And it only and this was with the safety net of my parents. Now I didn't have that. And I was like, there's no telling what is in my future led by my devices. You know, I mean, right now, it's like it is now, but I'm talking about true homelessness. You know, real, like, drugs coming into the system, the things that you do to get those drugs when you don't have a home and you don't have a true job. I was just like, I'm really in trouble. God gave me this true clarity of the hell that was my life coming up. As I'm sitting on this couch, and all of a sudden the door bursts open, and this girl comes in, and she is glowing, dude. I mean, glowing, just like an angel. And I've always had, side note, a very negative response to the people in AA that had that glowy look and were real smiley and chipper and all cheerleadery. You know, I really did not like those types, you know. And but she came in, and I did not feel that revulsion towards her. It was very genuine when she came in, and she's talking to me, and she's like, oh, you know, I heard I was getting a roommate. And she sat down, and she was like, so tell me where you're from and how you got here. And I'm telling her about my plight, you know, my story, because nobody, you've never heard a story like mine before. It's the worst. And she's telling me about her story. And she had had it rough too, you know. And I'm telling her, of course, more about mine, you know. Well, you think that's bad. I haven't stopped talking yet, so hold on, sister. And, you know, but what I could not, what I kept going back to was her eyes, you know, and just this genuine clarity. And there's just something going on with her. And I was like, well, wait a second. How long have you been here? And she said 3 months. And I was like, all right, how did you get from where you were 3 months ago to where you are now? And she lifted up her book, and she said, it's in here. And on this property, you will find a contact of friends, and you'll get in a conscious contact with God for a program of action, and you'll be healed. And, dude, I don't know why, but I believed her. I just believed her. I was hopeless. And she was so genuine, and she was like the living proof. And if any of y'all have read Bill's story about when Abby goes to Bill, and Bill is saying, I had to believe him. I was hopeless. She, in so many ways, I felt like she was my Abby, you know. And I just immediately was like, I'm in, because again, I was out of my own ideas of how to do this, and I was like, if this can really happen for me, if I can get what you have, then I so am going to try, because I cannot drink, and I cannot not drink, and I don't know what to do. I'm truly lost. And so, at that point, one would say, I thought, or at least I said, I've done step one. Check. This is not actually what I found out was the case, according to my sponsor. In a lot of ways, it was. I admitted that I was powerless and my life had become unmanageable. And to a certain degree, that had been true. A lot of my step one was prior to getting to that point. But I was also challenged to consider the powerlessness that one experiences once alcohol is removed. And once you are living life without alcohol, and exactly how powerless you feel when you are in the absolute raw, every nerve is raw. you have nothing to anesthetize it, and you're living life, and just how powerless you feel in that moment. And, you know, all that anybody is telling you to do at that point is take direction from someone else. And so you have no idea what's going on. You have no idea. You're absolutely in unfamiliar. I was in absolutely unfamiliar territory. Up to that point, the only thing that ever made me a whole person was to drink. So I'm at this point not even a whole person. I'm irritated, an irritated raw nerve. And all I am experiencing is my powerlessness. So there's a powerlessness with alcohol, and then there's a powerlessness without alcohol. So my step one experience, I remember I'd been there like a week, and I said, what about, am I even on step one? And she was like, I think you still need to work on it a little bit. And I was like, how can I be more powerless? And she goes, I don't know, I think you need to pray about it. And I was like, I'm going to kill this bitch. And I was like, but, you know, I did, because again, I was just out of why. So I did, I prayed, you know, I was like, God, I don't know why Kristen is asking me to pray for powerlessness, but she knows what's going on, and you know what's going on, and I don't know anything. You know, and over the next few days with this crazy prayer that I was praying, I really did start to see how I had very little power over everything. But a lot of my frustrations came over the fact that I did think I had some kind of power over things. And that was, you know, that was the dealio. And so, you know, and then, you know, I found that with step one and step two, there's kind of a dance that you do with that whole thing. One, two, and three, actually, with coming to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. And I would go to my sponsor, who, you know, and I would say, you know, this is really what blew my mind, is I had an absolute crippling mental obsession. It just was phenomenal. The crippling obsession just blew me away. But once I made up my mind to go through with the process, it calmed, it lightened. And I can only say that is attributed to God. That's the only thing. It was a power greater than me that calmed down my mental obsession to drink. I didn't do it. I'd always had it. It had always been with me. Always. But when I made up my mind on the couch that night with Kristen, and I asked her sincerely, how do I get from there to here? How did you get from there to here? And she told me, and I believed her, and I said, I'll do it. I want what you have. I'm willing to go to any length. The mental obsession, it didn't lift completely. I mean, no. I was uncomfortable as I could possibly be, yes. But the mental obsession lessened considerably. And I knew that was a power greater than myself that did that. And that helped me come, that was a piece of proof that allowed me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, because I was definitely insane. I was definitely insane. I cannot differentiate between the true and the false. My alcoholic life was my only normal life. That was the only normal life I had. I had to be restored to sanity, and that was only going to be from a power greater than myself, and only if I was willing for that to happen. So, and then, you know, there was, and during this time, I'm going to lots of meetings, and I'm doing lots of service work that I was told to do. Basically, I was doing anything I was told to do. I was working because I had to have a job to be self-sufficient, which is really painful. When you used to have an alcohol in your body all the time, and then all of a sudden you're not having alcohol in your body all the time, it hurts. It physically hurts. It hurts to not have. It hurts to not have it in your body. All of a sudden you're like, oh, my knees hurt, my legs hurt, my skin hurts. I think I got cancer. You know? Ow. Hurt. But it kept on going. So I was working, and I was going to, I don't know, in that recovery community, we had meetings. If you're on property, you had a meeting. And all the meetings were big book based. And then we had speaker meetings every night on Friday night, which is how I started to love speaker meetings, because I always got to hear people's experience on how it happened, you know, how they got it. So it was awesome. That's why it's such an honor to be here tonight. So anyway, third step was making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Here comes my personal any length. There were lots of any lengths that I had. This one was my personal biggest. I came into this program with a very good concept of God. It was what was given to me by my dad. He was a Methodist minister. And I'd been taught that God was good, God was big, God was powerful, God was forgiving, God was love. No bad things, no fire and brimstone, you know, nothing bad, nothing, you know, all good stuff. And so I carried on with that. Now I was a little confused why God decided He wanted me to be an alcoholic and be in so much pain. But I wasn't really all that mad at God. I just figured, you know, whatever. I don't get it, but, you know, I still didn't think, you know, I still didn't subscribe to the idea that God was bad or I hated God or anything like that. So when I got to any length, there was the sponsor that I had, and then there were staff members that were also kind of my pseudo-sponsors. And one of the things that I kept getting challenged on was, you need to put down, not throw away, they're not necessarily wrong, but you need to lay down your ideas about God. And I was like, why? I got a really good connection with God. I'm halfway there. Whatever. Yeah, which is so wrong. But in my arrogance, I was like, oh, me and God, we're like simpatico, man. And they were like, no, not really. No, that is not the case. You actually, not that you're wrong, but you actually, we're encouraging you to lay down everything you think you know so that you can have a new experience with God. That's all we're asking you to do, Lori. That's all we're asking you to do. Because the God that you've had this far, the God that you've been experiencing thus far is the God that you've been drunk with, you know? And I was like, yeah, but, and I kept challenging and they're like, listen, just listen to us. Just lay down. Just sit it down. You can pick it back up anytime you want to. But just sit it down. Just sit down your old ideas. And there's a part in how it works at the very bottom where it says that let go of your old ideas. It actually on 58, it says, some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. And that old idea that I had was about God. And although the idea that I had about God was very good and very loving, it was a God in a box. And I wasn't ready to change that. I wasn't ready to let it get bigger. I wasn't ready to touch it. And I was challenged on that. And I was challenged on that and challenged on that because I needed to have a new experience with God. And that was the any length that I had to go to. I had to set that down to let God get bigger. And it was hard. Until I did it, and once I did it, it wasn't nearly as hard as I thought it was going to be. And I did it right before my fourth step, and it allowed me to have a huge experience. And as a result, God gets bigger every day because it's not the God in my head. It's not the God between my ears. It's not the God of my dad's experience. It's the God of my experience, if that makes sense. So, I went, like I said, I did kind of a dance between 1, 2, and 3, and I looked at 61 through 63, which really talks about selfish and self-centeredness, and that was another thing I had a hard time with because I always thought that I wasn't a very selfish person. I thought I was a very giving person. I would give you the shirt off my back. I was very, very giving and loving and, you know, totally for my next, you know, my fellow man and everything. But when I started really reading about how I actually want everybody to play the part that I want them to play and how everybody will be happy if they just do things my way, you know, the things that it speaks of in 60 through 63 right before you go into the fourth step, gave me a whole new outlook on the fact of how exactly self-centered that I really am, which is really important before I dove into the fourth step. And the fourth step for me, I was so ready to take my fourth step. My sponsor actually held me off on it. I was chomping to go. I was so ready to take my fourth step. I was so ready, so ready. And she just was like, no, keep looking at 60 through 63. And I was like, okay, okay. And then when I was finally able to do my fourth step, it was like the world opened up to me because I had always blamed everyone for everything. I mean, for the way that I have felt and the way that I just all the hurt that had taken place in my life was so everyone and everything's fault. You know, how could you? I would never do that to you. Why did you do that to me? I would never cheat on you like that. I would never make you feel like that. I would never. Why did you? All the finger pointing in the world. And when I looked at the fourth, I mean, for me, you know, everybody has different experiences with the fourth step. For me, the fourth step blew my mind when I got into the fourth column and I looked at my part of my resentments. And I just was like, oh my God, that's what that is. I really started that whole thing off. I really was the one that was the instigator in that whole thing. You know, it absolutely revolutionized the whole way that I looked at all of my relationships that I had had thus far. As a result, it has changed the way that I experience you today. Every relationship that I have with you today is because of the fact that I did a fearless and thorough fourth step, and that I continue to do a personal inventory all the time in my relationships today. I have a new relationship with my fellows that is awesome because I can do that tool with assurance and accuracy, and I embrace it. But, you know, it then comes to the part where you have to share it with your sponsor, and that isn't always fun because there's some stuff that's just embarrassing, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, and some of it's like, you know, some of the stuff, it's not cool stuff. It's like, you know, you think, because I, you know, some of it's like, it's just embarrassing, you know. You want to be like, it's not like, yeah, I was really cool when this happened, that happened, you know, da, da, da. No, it's just like embarrassing stuff, or I got jealous because he did that, and then she had a really tight sweater on, and then he looked at her, and, you know, and it's just embarrassing, you know. I revealed too much. Anyway, after the fourth step and the fifth step, it's important. The most important thing about the fifth step is you do it, and you do it thoroughly, and you do it absolutely honestly, and you don't leave anything out. Don't leave anything out. There's no reason to. Your sponsor doesn't care what you say. You can tell them anything. You can say it all. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't. You know, when I told my sponsors, they couldn't have cared less. And with my sponsees, when they tell me, there's only one thing that I want, and that's for them to tell me everything. I have absolutely, I'm not invested at all in what it is as much as they get it all out. And then after the character defects are out there, then it's like, wow. I mean, I remember with my first 6 and 7, I was just like, I'm so glad that this is over, and I realized I'm almost out of time. So the main thing that I want to really wrap this all up with is I'm glad I mentioned the fourth step, because you need to do that all the time. It's a main tool that you need to do with step 10. I was working at that recovery center after I did the steps and started sponsoring people. Then I started working there, and I had the experience of sponsoring people. I still sponsor people. Sponsoring people is the absolute highlight of my life. Give back what you have, and you'll get more. It's not, I heard this yesterday. I heard it a long time ago, and I love it. You don't, it's not so much, giving it. You have to have it to give it away. You have to give it away to get it in the first place. Really, it's such a beautiful thing. I'm honored to sponsor people. I'm honored to be here, and I'm honored to be living this life. Thank you.
Thank you for your story. It was great.
First I slip, and then I crib. A hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Something that set me free, and I'd arrive to a world in harmony. Below there's a vision that one day. Where the promises are.